Chapter 1. First, the apparitions. Horatio says 'tis but our fantasy, and will not let belief take hold of him, touching this dreaded sight, twice seen of us. Therefore I have entreated him along with us, to watch the minutes of this night, that if again this apparition come, he may approve our eyes and speak to it. From Amulet, Prince Denmark. Attributed to the dramaturge Shakespeare. Circa M2. That phantoms should haunt Macragg, after all the horrors that had been recently visited upon the planet and the 500 worlds it held in fealty, came as no surprise to anyone. The population of Ultramar's 500-world dominion had suffered the atrocity of Kalth, the gross treachery of Lorgar, the widespread bloodshed that followed in consequence, and the pan-galactic devastation of the so-named Ruin Storm. Every single one of those billions of souls was in a state of existential shock. The monumental events had left psychological scars, ghost wounds that lingered in the minds of men. Combat traumas, griefs and private losses, physical injuries, bitternesses, grudges, stress disorders, warp-fueled nightmares, and other less classifiable after-effects. Kalth, the ignition point, barely more than 2 years past, had haunted the citizens of Ultramar with such phantoms ever since. No, when the latest apparitions came, the only surprise was that they should be so very real. Over 10 successive nights, phantoms stalked the high towers and wall walks of Macragg City, under the shadow of the fortress, beneath a night sky that had been a permanent starless russet, like blood-soaked black cloth since the coming of the Ruin Storm 2 years before. No stars shone, none that looked healthy or matched any charts, at least. Even the brightest of the capital world's 4 moons was seldom visible through the inky cosmological swirl of the enduring warp storm. The corpse of the Word-Bearer's immense warship, the Furious Abyss, could sometimes be seen in the western skies as the orbital breakers went about their work, but this was merely a sad relic of past bloodshed. During the day, when sunlight fell upon Macragg, it fell only as a tarnished golden haze, as if through battlefield smoke. It fell upon a haunted city, Macragg City, Magna Macragg Civitas, the greatest city in the Imperial East, a city so mighty that it shared the name of the world it stood on, for the city was the world, and the world was the city. Filling the vast lowland plains, from the Hera's crown peaks in the north to the sea in the south, it was a testament to the power of Imperial mankind, and to one man in particular. The apparitions appeared only after nightfall. Footsteps were heard in empty corridors where no one walked. Voices mumbled from inside block-cut walls or the roots of staircases. Sometimes the sound of hasty running feet rushed down deserted colonnades. Once an odd and mournful laugh was heard echoing through an Odeon hall. Most often came the aching melody of a bowed string instrument playing in some cavernous place of eternal echoes. These manifestations were heard by household guardsmen on night patrol, by cooks and servants, by attachés hurrying to late conferences, by cleaners and servitors, by senators coming to the residency. They were heard everywhere, from the high castrum of the Paleopolis, where the residency, high senate and precentral barracks shared the castellated summit with the monolithic immensity of the fortress of Hera, right down across the demes of the city to the lowliest insulae and worker habs on the southern coast, from the labouring zones of the eastern wards, and even from the squalid slums beyond the Servian wall in the west. It is likely they had been occurring for several nights before they were first reported. Junior staffers and servants had become timid and superstitious in this new age of darkness, and were individually reluctant to speak up and tell their superiors what they thought they had heard in some lonely room or deserted wing. The Lord of Macragg, the Avenging Sun, had issued strict orders that all phenomena were to be reported, however. We can't trust the physical integrity of our universe anymore, he told Yuton. Its laws no longer operate the way we think they operate. Everything that might once have been dismissed as a trick of the mind or a figment of the imagination must be taken seriously and investigated. The warp is reaching into us, ma'am, and we do not yet recognize half of the faces it wears. I will not be taken by surprise again. I will not be infiltrated. As I was at Kalth, those were the unspoken words at the end of the sentence. The Avenging Sun could seldom bring himself to speak the name of that dear planet. Phantoms of his own haunted him. Yuton impressed the Lord's directive upon the staff of the Residency and the public officers of the Civitas. But ironically, it was she who, the very next night, heard a bowed instrument playing in a side chamber of the counting house, where there was no player, no instrument, no bow, nor even the space or conditions to produce the echo that had accompanied the tune. Stories accumulated for several nights after the Chamberlain's report. Spirits were abroad in Magna Macrag Civitas. Their range was wide, but the focus seemed to be the Residency and the barracks and parklands adjacent to it. Voden Badorum, captain of the Precental Household Guard, mobilized sweep parties to watch for occurrences and record or even challenge them, and he also consulted with agents of the Astra Telepathica and the Mechanicum for advice and counsel. The Lord of Macrag studied the reports as they came in and sought the wisdom of his high officers and senior advisers, looking for explanations that could be grounded in science, or at least those parts of human science that lay adjacent to the unknowable laws of the warp. He also summoned Titus Prato, a supervising centurion of the 13th Legion's newly reinstated Librarius. After Kalth and the hellish losses inflicted on the 13th by psychic warfare and warpcraft, the Lord of Macrag had effectively repealed the Edict of Nicaea, which had stringently outlawed the use of psychers within the Legiones Astartes. The edict had been the will of the Emperor, and had been enforced as such. However, the Lord of Macrag felt it had deprived his legion of its most effective weapon at Kalth. The repeal was his decision to make, and he made it with confidence. There were no brother primarchs to consult, no council to convene, no father to turn to. The Lord of Macrag, like the city of Macrag, stood alone in the night, besieged by storms that made communication impossible. The Lord of Macrag, Rubute Gilliman, was his own authority more than ever. He overthrew the edict, for the duration of the emergency at least, for the good of Ultramar. This exercise of authority was the action of a lord who believed that he wielded the power of the Emperor himself. Until now, only Malkador the Sigillite had been entrusted with such influence, and he had been the Imperial Regent. And Regent was a word used aloud even less often and with less ease than was the word Kalth. Titus Prato, a hooded giant in cobalt blue Mark IV armour, came to the Residency directly from the sacristy of the Librarius, which had been unlocked for use within the fortress. His lord awaited in a high chamber overlooking the city. The Avenging Sun was working diligently at an antique cogitator. Nearby, his great granite desk was piled with papers and slates. The last rays of smoked gold sunlight shone through the tall, narrow windows. Night was encroaching. Prato lowered his psychic hood, unclasped his helm, and stood respectfully bareheaded, helm tucked under his left arm, the clasps and seal straps dangling.
"Apparitions walk, Titus," Gilliman said, without looking up.
"They do, my lord," Prato said, and nodded.
"Every night," Gilliman went on, "more footsteps, more muttering, and this music. The music is a recurring manifestation, a bowed instrument or instruments."
"A psaltery, we think, my lord."
Gilliman looked up at Prato with piqued interest. "A psaltery?"
from the pitch and tone, a particular high and sharp resonance, though there may be more than one instrument. Some are deeper toned, though the note quality is the same, perhaps mezzo or bass psalteries, which have larger sound boxes.
All this from verbal accounts? Asked Gilliman.
No, my lord. Last evening a high-grade servitor in the pantry of the West Dining Room made a vox recording.
Gilliman stood. I had not been told. Do you have it?
Prato nodded and activated a vox module clamped to his belt to play back the audio clip. A few seconds of haunting, plaintive music played, thin, high, long notes that had an ethereal quality. The clip ended.
Shall I play it again, my lord? Asked Prato.
Gilliman shook his head. His mind was such that one hearing was sufficient for him to process all particulars.
Assuredly, a psaltery, he mused. The melody was in the pitch of D, though I do not recognize the tune. So, it can be recorded.
Yes, lord.
This reassures me somewhat. A psychic intrusion or some assault of the warp upon our imaginations would not leave a sonic fingerprint.
No, my lord, replied Prato. We seem to be hearing physical sounds transmitted to us somehow. It would explain why, between us, the Librarius and the Astrotelepathica have detected no trace of psychic activity whatsoever.
Gilliman nodded. He was wearing the dark, heavy robes of a senator or consul, though cut to a different scale of being.
Be seated, he told Prato with a sidelong gesture.
Titus Prato hesitated for a moment while he selected an appropriate place to sit down. The Lord's chamber was part of a suite of rooms in the upper level of the residency, which Prato knew had been the private accommodation of Conor, the Primarch's adoptive father. Lord Gilliman had changed very little of the decor. The walls were still hung with paintings of people and events that bore significance to the local history of Macragg, but had precious little to do with the greater galactic narrative of the Imperium. The main change that Lord Gilliman had made in the decades he had occupied the residency was to have most of the human-scaled furniture removed and replaced with objects built for a Primarch's dimensions. The desk, 4 chairs, a footstool, and a daybed. There were other items proportioned for the physicality of a Legiones Astartes battle brother, and Prato sat upon such a chair. The room, therefore, contained 3 magnitudes of furniture to provide for the Lord of Macragg and any of the advisers and subjects who might attend him. Positioned correctly with one of the Lord's massive chairs in the foreground, a legion-scaled item of furniture in the middle ground, and a chair for human build furthest away, it was possible to play amusing and impossible tricks upon the mind, as the apparent recession of the furniture suggested a distance in the room that the walls and ceiling denied. Reverse the positions, and the room appeared to have no depth at all.
The echo, said Gilliman, returning to the ancient brass-fitted cogitator on his oversized desk. Like the chamber, the cogitator was an inheritance from his stepfather, Conor. In the old days of Ultramar, before contact with the Crusade fleets of Terra brought new technologies, Conor had effectively run the fiefdom from this room with that Kohlgestalt instrument from the golden age of technology. The echo is part of the sound, Gilliman said. This has been mentioned by several witnesses about several apparitions. The quality of the echo is not an acoustic product of the environment.
No, lord, Prato agreed. The West Dining Room's pantry would not produce an echo like that. I had it tested by the adepts of the Mechanicum.
You did? Asked Gilliman.
Why? Because I knew you would have ordered such a test if I had not.
A brief, appreciative smile crossed the avenging son's mouth.
We will solve this puzzle, Titus, Gilliman said.
We will, my lord, assuredly.
Bring all new data directly to me, day or night.
I will, my lord.
Prato rose to his feet, sensing that his audience was ended. Gilliman noticed that the librarian had been regarding with some interest books and data slates piled on a side table.
You read, Titus? The avenging son asked.
Of course, my lord. Gilliman demurred with a slight shake of his head.
You misunderstand. Of course you can read, but I don't mean data or tactical updates or informational material. Do you read fiction? Drama? Poetry? History?
Prato maintained a solemn face, though he was amused. There were times when Lord Gilliman of Ultramar seemed to know everything about everything in astonishing detail, yet he could also be childlike in his naivety and not understand very basic things about the people and the culture surrounding him.
"I do, my lord," said Prato, "as I believe someone in this very room said in the address to mark the recommencement of the Librarius program, our minds are our primary weapons, so it pays to exercise them well."
Gilliman laughed and nodded.
"I did say that," he agreed.
"I read extensively to that end," said Prato. "I find the notions and wisdoms contained in literature and poetry push my mind to places that pure technical reading does not. I enjoy the epic cycles of Tashkara and the philosophies of Zimban and Poul Padraig Grossman."
Gilliman signalled his approval with the tip of his head. "All unification era, of course," he said. "You should explore the classics."
He crossed to the side table and took up a data slate. He handed it to Prato.
"You'll enjoy this," he said.
"Thank you, my lord."
Prato studied the title. "Amulet, Prince Demark?"
"It's drama, Titus. Ancient stuff from M2 or earlier. One of the few extant works by Shakespeare."
"Why this, my lord?"
Gilliman shrugged. "My father had me read it as a child. I was reminded of it by current events, so I had it fetched from the residency biblios. In the ancient kingdom of Demark, ghosts walked upon the palace battlements and are premonitions of great societal change in the court of that realm."
Prato shook the slate approvingly.
"I will enjoy it," he said.
Gilliman nodded and turned back to his cold gestalt machine. The audience was over.
Tit, 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 tit.
The cogitator had an odd, synthesized alert chime. It was an antique device. Every 25 seconds it burbled its little noise, trying to alert the avenging sun to the new information it had acquired. Gilliman ignored the chime. He did not need to be told. He had already noticed the matter that the cogitator was trying to bring to his attention. A star. A new star. It was the first star that had been visible in McCragg's night sky for over 2 years. Gilliman sat staring through the chamber windows at the star, which glimmered alone in the otherwise bloody, swirling night sky. He had scribbled down its position on a note slate. Eastern limits, low on the horizon, rising between the peaks of Kalut and Andromache. He had spotted it with his naked eyes 15 minutes ago, a good 3 minutes before the cogitator had begun its persistent burbling. Conor, great Conor, battle king, had run McCragg, world and city alike, from this room and with this cogitator. At night, when the mechanisms of bureaucracy had shut down, he had sat here alone, monitoring data traffic and news flows. He had sat at his teak desk, looking out of the deep windows, observing his realm. In the daytime, Conor had ruled McCragg from the Senate floor. At night, this chamber had been the focus of his authority. Gilliman remembered that. He remembered his stepfather's intensity, even in repose. As a youth, Gilliman had come to the residency and watched Conor sitting by the cogitator after hours, reading from the day's reports and slates, reviewing briefings for the next day, looking up every time the data engine chimed.
Tit, 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 tit!
Until Gilliman came to McCragg, capital world of Ultramar's 500, Conor had been the epitome of statesman, politician and warlord. No one, not even Gilliman, could have imagined how Conor's adopted son would come to eclipse him. Robute Gilliman, a genetically enhanced post-human, one of only 18 in the galaxy, had fallen to McCragg out of the skies at the whim of fates beyond mortal ken. His blood father, it later transpired,
was the nameless Emperor of Terra. Like all of the 18 sons, all of the Primarchs, Gilliman had been stolen from his father's genetic nursery and cast out across space. No one really knew how this action had been accomplished, or by what, or for what reason. When pressed on the subject, and he could seldom be pressed on any subject, Gilliman's blood father had attested that the abduction and scattering of the 18 Primarch offspring had been an action of the ruinous powers of the warp, an event designed to thwart the schemes of mankind. Gilliman did not place much faith in this. It smacked of foolishness to suggest that his blood father should be so naive as to be gulled by chaos so. To have his genetically engineered heirs stolen and scattered in some bizarre diaspora? Nonsense. Gilliman believed that a great deal more deliberate purpose had been at the heart of it. He knew his gene father. The man, a man was far too slight a word, possessed a mind that had conceived a universal plan, a plan that would take thousands or even millions of years to orchestrate and accomplish. The Emperor was the architect of a species. The Primarchs were central to that ambition. The Emperor would not have lost them or permitted them to be stolen. Gilliman believed that his father had arranged or allowed the dispersal. 18 perfect genetically engineered heirs were not enough. They had to be tested and tempered. Scattering them across the tides of space and time to see who would survive and who would succeed, that was the project of a true luminary. Gilliman had fallen on Macragge and had been raised as a son by the first man of that world to be a ruler, a statesman, and a warlord. By his 12th year, it was apparent from his inhuman stature and abilities that Rabute Gilliman was not simply a man, he was a demigod. He had been tested by circumstances, and he had not been found wanting.
Tit, 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 tit.
12 years old, coming into the chamber at night, seeing Conor in his chair, the cogitator chiming, the windows undraped. 12 years old, already as tall as his stepfather, and already more physically powerful. Another year or two, and he would have to have furniture, armour and weapons made especially for him.
Tit, 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 tit.
Conor believed in contingency. Any plan, no matter how flawless, needed a backup. Gilliman believed his blood father thought this too. Contingency was something Conor and Gilliman's blood father agreed on. Their advice would have been the same. Do not believe in perfection, because it can be taken away. Always have a fallback you can live with. Always know how victory can be achieved in a different way. Always have the practical to compensate for any theoretical. The Imperium of Man was the most perfect vision of unity imaginable. The Emperor and his heirs spent more than 2 centuries making it a possibility. If it failed, was one to simply despair? Did a man collapse and rail at the universe for compromising his plan? Or did he regroup and turn to his contingency? Did he demonstrate to fate that there is always another way? Horus Lupercal, another of the 18 Primarchs, but in Gilliman's opinion far from the best, had been selected as the heir among heirs, and in a miserably short space of time had been found wanting. He had risen in revolt, twisting some other Primarchs against their gene father too. The first Gilliman had known of this sacrilege was when Lorgar's bastards had turned upon the 500 worlds at Kalth and, in darkest treachery, had shattered that planet. Shameless. Atrocious. 2 years had passed, and there was not a second of them when Gilliman had not thought of Lorgar's treachery and, by extension, Horus's. Gilliman would be avenged. It would be a simple revenge, ultimately, the kind of revenge Conor had taught him at the cutting edge of a gladius.
Tit, 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 tit.
There was a new star in heaven tonight. 100 days ago, Gilliman had set the old Kohlgestalt cogitator to alert him to any stellar changes. Gilliman had known what to expect if it worked. If.
Tonight he had seen the new star immediately. He had been sitting in his chair beside the cogitator, facing the windows, the way his stepfather had passed the long nights. The star, a light, a beacon, hope.
Deet, 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 deet.
Gilliman leaned over and pressed the cancel button to kill the persisting chime. There was a knock at the chamber door. Enter. It was Yuton.
My lord, the old woman began.
I've already seen it, ma'am, said Gilliman. Yuton looked puzzled.
The apparition? She asked.
Gilliman stood. Begin again, he said. Badorum, commander of the Precental household, had gathered a squad of men from the night watch in the hallway leading to the hydroponics gallery. By human standards, they were all large, powerful men, though they seemed like children beside the Primarch. Badorum was a seasoned officer in late middle age. Like his soldiers, he wore steel, silver and grey, with a short cape of cobalt blue. His strap-hung plasma weapon was chromed and immaculate. Yuton, the chamberlain, a tall, fragile stick figure in a long white gown, led the way, clomping with her staff. Gilliman followed, impatient to arrive, but respectful enough to walk at the old woman's best pace. The approach was dark, as if the lights had been switched off or had failed. The only luminosity came from the lanterns and visor lights of the householders and the faint green glow of the gallery beyond the door. Gilliman could already hear it. A psaltery. A bass psaltery, pealing its long, sad, pure notes into the night air. The echo was pronounced. The hydroponics gallery was a large space, but Gilliman was sure it could not have produced quite that kind of echo. The sound seemed to come from the heart of the world, as if it was rising out of some tectonically riven abyss.
"What have you seen?" asked Gilliman, ignoring the rattle of bowed salutes that Badorum and the Night Watch offered him.
"I was only just summoned, lord," said Badorum. "Clenart, you were here." The soldier stepped forward and removed his helm respectfully.
"We were patrolling, my lord, and approaching this gallery when we first heard the noise. Music, just as now."
"Clenart, look at me," Gilliman said.
The soldier raised his eyes to meet the avenging sun's gaze. He had to tilt his head back a long way.
"You saw something."
"Yes, my lord, indeed so," the man replied. "A great figure in black, made of blackness as it seemed. It stepped out of the shadows and was solid. It was wrapped in iron, my lord."
"In iron?"
"In metal. It was armoured, even the face, not a visor, a mask."
"How big?" asked Yuton.
"As big," the soldier began. He paused. "As big as him, my lady."
He gestured down the hallway. Titus Prato had just come into view, escorted by four Ultramarines battle brothers. As large as a space marine of the Legiones Astartes. A giant, then.
"Another sighting, my lord?" Prato asked.
"Can you scan the area?" asked Gilliman.
"I have done so, but I will again," Prato replied. "There is no psychic trace here. The passive monitors would have triggered long before I arrived."
"But you hear the music, Titus."
"I do, my lord."
Gilliman reached out his hand. Prato, without hesitation, drew his bolt gun and slapped it into his Primarch's waiting palm. Gilliman checked its readiness quickly and turned towards the gallery door. The weapon was a little too small for his hand. It looked like a pistol.
"My lord," Badorum began, "should we not go in before you and—"
"As you were, commander," said Prato. He did not need to read his master's mind to be sure of the determination of his intent.
Gilliman entered the green twilight of the hydroponics gallery. Inside it was warm and humid. The lights were on some night cycle pattern. He could hear the gurgle of the water feeding the tanks and the soft drip of the sluices.
There was a pungent scent of grass and leaf mulch. The phantom music was louder inside, and its echo more profound and inexplicable. Prato followed Gilliman. He had drawn his combat sword. Badorum followed him, his plasma gun braced at his shoulder in a sweeping aim. "I don't," Badorum began. The shadows parted in front of them, and a figure loomed where no figure had been. It seemed to grow out of the darkness, as if it had come on stage through some invisible curtain.
"In the name of terror," Gilliman breathed.
The figure was no apparition. It was real and solid. More particularly, he recognized it. The iron mask, the unmaintained Mark III plate, the insignia of the 4th Legion Astartes. Gilliman knew too well the shuffling, crippled gait that spoke of chronic and unhealing illness. It was worse than when last he had observed it.
"Warsmith Dantioch," he said.
"My honoured lord,"
Barabbas Dantioch of the Iron Warriors replied.
"How can you be here, Dantioch? No ships have arrived in weeks. How can you be here without us knowing of your arrival?"
Gilliman paused suddenly. Dantioch's greeting had been accompanied by a distinct echo.
"When last I heard," said Gilliman, "you are half a segmentum away in the eastern fringes on Sotha."
"Yes, my lord Gilliman," replied Dantioch. "And I still am."